So, reading from Exodus chapter 22, verses 1 to 15. Whoever steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If a thief is caught breaking in at night and is struck a fatal blow, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, the defender is guilty of bloodshed. Anyone who steals must certainly make restitution. But if they have nothing, they must be sold to pay for their theft. If the stolen animal is found alive in their possession, whether ox or donkey or sheep, they must pay back double. If anyone grazes their livestock in a field or vineyard and lets them stray and they graze in someone else's field, the offender must make restitution from the best of their own field or vineyard. If a fire breaks out and spreads into thorn bushes so that it burns sheaves of corn or standing corn or the whole field, the one who started the fire must make restitution. If anyone gives a neighbor silver or goods for safekeeping and they are stolen from the neighbor's house, the thief, if caught, must pay back double. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house must appear before the judges, and they must determine whether the owner of the house has laid hands on the other person's property. In all cases of illegal possession of an ox, a donkey, a sheep, a garment, or any other lost property about which someone says, "This is mine," both parties are to bring their cases before the judges. The one whom the judges declare guilty must pay back double to the other. If anyone gives a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any other animal to their neighbor for safekeeping, and it dies, or is injured, or is taken away while no one is looking, the issue between them will be settled by the taking of an oath before the Lord that the neighbor did not lay hands on the other person's property. The owner is to accept this, and no restitution is required. But if the animal was stolen from the neighbor, restitution must be made by the owner. If it was torn to pieces by wild animals, the neighbor shall bring in the remains as evidence and shall not be required to pay for the torn animal. If anyone borrows an animal from their neighbor and it is injured or dies while the owner is not present, they must make restitution. But if the owner is with the animal, the borrower will not have to pay. If the animal was hired, the money paid for the hire covers the loss.
Please be seated. And now Natalia is going to come and bring us the next chunk of Exodus 22. She's going to read it in Russian, and the words in English will be up on the screen. So thank you. Please come on up.
Исход 22, 16 стиха. «Если обольстит кто девицу необрученную и переспит с нею, пусть даст ей вино и возьмет ее себе в жену. А если отец не согласится и не захочет выдать ее за него, пусть заплатит отцу столько серебра, сколько полагается на вино девицам. Ворожей не оставляй в живых. Всякий скотоложник да будет предан смерти». Приносящий жертву богам, кроме одного Господа, да будет истреблен. Пришельца не притесняй и не угнетай его, ибо вы сами были пришельцами в земле египетской. Ни вдовы, ни сироты не притесняйте. Если же ты притеснишь их, то тогда они возопьют ко мне. Я услышу вопль их, и воспламенится гнев мой, и убью вас мечом, и будут жены ваши вдовами, и дети ваши сиротами». Если дашь деньги взаймы бедному из народа моего, то не притесняй его и не налагай на него роста. Если возьмешь залог одежду ближнего твоего, до захождения солнца возврати ее, ибо она есть единственный покров у него. Она – одеяние тела его, в чем он будет спать. Итак, когда он возопьет ко мне, я услышу, ибо я милосерд. Судья, не злословь, и начальника в народе твоем не поноси. Немедли приносить мне начатки от гумна твоего и от точила твоего. Отдавай мне первенцев из сынов твоих. То же делай с волом твоим и с овцою твоею, и со слом твоим. 7 дней пусть они будут при матери своей, а в восьмой день отдавай их мне. И будете у меня людьми святыми, и мясо растерзанного зверем в поле не ешьте, сам бросайте его.
Thank you, Natalia. And now I'll just read the last bit of our passage for today, Exodus 23:1-9. Do not spread false reports. Do not help a guilty person by being a malicious witness. Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd, and do not show favoritism to a poor person in a lawsuit. If you come across your enemy's ox or donkey wandering off, be sure to return it. If you see the donkey of someone who hates you fallen down under its load, do not leave it there. Be sure you help them with it. Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the innocent. Do not oppress a foreigner. You yourselves know what it was like, how it feels to be a foreigner, because you were foreigners in Egypt. Well, we've covered quite a lot of laws there. Next week we just about finish this chunk of laws, get back to a little bit of the story. The BBC's Life's Big Questions a few years ago examined the idea of a world with no rules. And they start with a quote from someone they call Will, who was 28 and from London, and he says this, I'm in my late 20s and I'm feeling more and more constrained by rules. From the endless signs that tell me to stand on the right on escalators or skateboarding forbidden in public places, to all those unwritten societal rules, such as the expectation that I should settle down, buy a house and have a family. Do we really need all these rules? Why should I follow them? And what would happen if we all ignored them? Now, I don't know if everyone in this room shares this rebel streak. One of my old pastors put it that some people are natural policemen and some people are natural bandits. And I find that quite helpful. Some of us are natural rule breakers and some of us actually really like rules. That's not our problem. But a lot of us do have an instinctive aversion to rules. And in Christian terms, that's often been put in terms of where we live by the Spirit and not by the letter. Set us free from rules and structures, and then we'll have real relationships. Then we'll have real engagement with God, real worship. The rules are just holding us back. And of course, it is right to recognize that there are dangers and limitations of rules and organization. But we also need to recognize that every time God rescues his people in the Bible, he brings them to himself, and then he says, here's how you should live as my people. People in community with the triune God, people in community with each other. Good rules protect people and provide structure for relationship and partnership to flourish. And actually, the BBC article I referenced, they go on to basically say that. You know, without common rules, they say, you can't even communicate. Language involves common rules about how we understand and use words. You certainly can't create the joint enterprises that lead to a flourishing society without common rules. And so I know I felt in Exodus, we had about 19 chapters of exciting story, and suddenly it's ground to a halt as we've hit these laws. But there's something necessary for human flourishing here. This is how human community can reflect God's heart. God rescues us by his grace. He loves us when we're helpless and guilty. God uses his power to rescue us when we're trapped in our sin and guilt. And then God draws us to be with him and like him so that we will know and reflect his heart. And that is what this law from over 3,000 years ago is doing. It reveals God to us and it draws us to be like him. And so as we've moved on from the Ten Commandments, we've seen that different sections deal with different headings. So we've had a section on true worship, you know, no idols, that command. Last week, we also saw protecting the most vulnerable workers. Last week, we saw that God cares for and protects life, quite a long exposition of do not murder, the sixth commandment. And I think in a sense, what we're seeing here is the last three commandments being expanded. You shall not steal, you shall not lie, you shall not covet. Yeah, what should this community look like so that everyone flourishes in God's people? So we're going to start with the largest chunk in today's passage, the first 15 verses of Exodus 22, where God calls his people to care for other people's property. Most of us will care reasonably well for our own property, and if we don't, we bear the consequences ourselves. But how do we treat other people's property? And he starts with the sort of the worst case, as it were, the person who steals someone else's cow or sheep. And by the time that this is discovered, the cow or sheep has been sold or killed and eaten, so there's no way of getting the animal back. So God demands that after the theft is proven, the thief should pay back 5 cows for every one stolen, or 4 sheep for every sheep stolen. And you might be thinking straight away, oh, last week we saw eye for eye. This doesn't seem to match up. They stole 1 sheep. Why are they paying 4? But that fails to consider 2 things. Firstly, what will deter thieves? And secondly, what will restore relationship? So if you only have to pay the cost of the animal stolen when you get caught, unless you get caught 100% of the time, it's still worth stealing the sheep. But if you know that you're going to get caught and then pay back 4 times the time, well, even if there's only a 25% chance of being caught, it's not worth it. This acts as a deterrent for theft. But it also does something else. If the thief gets caught, and in this society, it's someone from your clan, it's someone from the village, it's someone from the next village over, it's someone you're going to keep meeting. It's not an anonymous person. You discover they've stolen it. What's going to restore your relationship such that you can actually be friends and not have a feud? Well, if your lost sheep gets you 4 back at the end of the process, you no longer feel bitter. You're almost like saying, well, do you want to steal another one? I've ended up richer. The relationship is restored because there's such good restitution that the person who's stolen from no longer feels like they're hard done by. You see, these rules about property are not just about what is right for property, but it's about good relationships among God's people. In verses 2 and 3, we see the balance. Yes, you have a right to defend yourself from a thief, but defending your property doesn't give you carte blanche to kill people. Because we care about property because we care about people. If a thief breaks in at night, you can't see clearly. Your family are in the house. You don't know whether they're armed and how dangerous they are. If you kill them then, no one's going to blame you. But when the sunlights come up and you can see them, and you know that they're only after property and they're not aiming to harm you, if you kill them then, you've valued property above human life. And that's not okay. That is roughly the law in the UK. You know, if someone's breaking into your house and you think they might be armed and you're scared for your life, well, then you may use force. But if they're running away with some property and you're angry at them and you shoot them in the back, that is illegal. You can't defend your property simply as property and be careless of human life. Because we care about property because we care about human life, because we care about human beings. Verse 3 deals with the person too poor to pay back. They should work as a slave in that world. In a sense, today, I guess we have insurance to cover the costs, and then we send people to prison. But it's the same sort of, even poverty doesn't become an excuse. Verse 4 adds something slightly weird, that if the animal's found, you only pay back double rather than the 4 times. And all of this is dealing with theft. It's saying you deliberately take someone else's property for your own advantage, and God is saying, I'm against that. Because a community can't thrive if everyone has to use all their energy to guard their possessions. If it's a free-for-all where might is right, and whoever is strong or sneaky enough can take whatever they like. One of the basic things that leads to prosperity for a society is rule of law, which protects property. And if societies don't have that, it is almost impossible for them to become wealthy and prosperous for everybody. So God wants his people to care for other people's property, first of all, most basically, by not stealing. And actually, there are lots of subtle ways we can end up stealing. We'll come on to that in a little while. But he also wants them to care for other people's property by being careful in how they treat it. And so, firstly, verses 5 to 6 say, if your carelessness causes damage to other people's property, you know, you light a fire in your property and the sparks go over and set fire to their field, well, you have to pay for it. It's your job to put things right if your carelessness damages other people's property, because you should care about their property as much as you care for your own. You should love your neighbor as yourself. And verses 7 to 15 detail what happens when you look after or borrow or hire someone else's property and it gets damaged or stolen or lost. And that gets quite complicated. There's a process for figuring out who is responsible for what. And sometimes that involves the judges. Two people are giving a different account of what's happened. The judges are going to have to determine who's telling the truth. Was it stolen, or is the person who was entrusted with it keeping it for themselves and pretending it was stolen? Jumping on to verses 14 and 15. It's interesting, there's a difference between if you borrow an animal and the owner is present, he's kind of still responsible for it, or if he's been paid money for the hire, versus if he's just kindly lent his animal to the owner, to the other person, and it gets damaged or lost when he's not there. I'm not quite sure that we need to apply for every detail of that, but I think it speaks to the fact that there's complexity in this world of possessions. Sometimes things get broken and lost, and it's hard to figure out who is actually to blame. Sometimes things get broken and lost, and it's just something you have to accept. So we should aim to be careful with property of other people. But those of us who lend our property also need to be aware that things get broken in this world. Things get lost. And if we're aiming to love others well, we need to remember that people matter more than things. Things of this world are passing away. So we care for those things, we care for their possessions as part of loving them. But we ourselves, as we lend, have to be prepared to lose those things sometimes as part of loving other people. That's part of the challenge. Care for other people's property, but don't care for your own so strongly that you don't love people in need. In all of this, we see that God is concerned that his people should care for other people's property as carefully as they would for their own. And he's concerned that disputes over property, over material possessions, doesn't tear people apart. And so he sets up procedures for figuring out what's happened and then making sure that there is restitution, there is a repayment where damage has been done. Well, this is all a system set up for people who are grazing livestock and living in a pre-industrial society. It's also rules for a nation before Christ, and now we're a church rather than a nation. We don't have all the same legal responsibilities in a church as you would do if you were running a nation. So the question is, what does this mean for how Christians behave in the world? What does this mean for how we treat others? What does this mean for how we care for each other in the Christian community? And you might want to think about this both in terms of how we care for other people's property and in terms of how we respond when our own property is damaged. And I am not going to give you the answers. I'm going to ask you to do a bit of work, trying to figure out, what does this mean for us today? Where does this challenge us, perhaps, might be another question. You may not be tempted to go and rob a bank, but where does this start to challenge us today? So what difference does it make for how we behave in the world? What difference does it make for how we care for each other as Christian community? Have a talk for 3 or 4 minutes about what this means for today. Okay, I'd be interested to hear if a few people want to share some examples or some principles they've figured out for how this relates to today's world. Maybe something already that God's putting on your conscience, you're like, oops, I haven't done that, and you're willing to share that sort of example to help us to think through it. But yeah, any examples for today of what this sort of care for other people looks like? Oh, such a buzz of conversation, and it's just no one is willing to admit to anything. Kim. Yep. So as a society, we We say we value life, but often we show that we value material possessions more than life, and that might be part one of the factors in the abortion debates. Yep, thank you. Mark, I think you had a... Yep. Yeah. 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 So empathy, thinking about how the other person values stuff. We might say, "Oh, that's just never mind. It was just a pile of junk." But you know, they'd spent a lot of time or effort, or they can't afford a replacement. It's not just a pile of junk to them. We need to take into account their view of it and their concern for their property. Yep. Any other? Charlie. Yeah, so the whole, yeah. Yeah, so it's very interesting that in the Exodus Law Code, the restoration of relationships is always a very big factor. In our legal system, it's very much about sort of, yes, making sure justice is done, but we don't really intend for relationships to be restored as part of that process. And it might almost be that the court process makes it harder to have restored relationship. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. 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 So not being reckless with possessions and other people's possessions, but also with the world. And I think some of the later laws sections in Deuteronomy have environmental elements to them. So yeah. Claire. Yes. Yeah. Thanks, Claire. So there's a sense in which this passage is all about how you treat other people's possessions, but we can sometimes be too possessive about our own possessions and say, they're all mine. And there's a right sense of going, well, they're gifts from God to be used for his world. Yeah. Bev? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so if, as Christians, when other people wrong us in this area of property and other things, you know, maybe we lent something and they wrecked it, or maybe they stole something, if we can reach out with forgiveness and restore relationship, that's actually very countercultural. That's very weird, and a very good witness. Yeah. Andy. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it may not be that the 3 or 4 or 5 times might not always be realistic, but the sense of I'm not just doing the bare minimum to sort of save face or avoid the police getting involved or whatever, but if I'm in the wrong, I will take the initiative and I will try and be abundant in my restitution rather than the bare minimum because I was in the wrong and I want relationship restored. Yeah, thank you. Hector. Yes, you need to be careful. If you lend something, you need to be prepared for it not to come back. Is that what you're saying? Yes. If your attitude is, I've lent it and it must come back pristine, you need to make sure that the person knows that and that they're happy with that. And if not, then it can get a bit complicated if you have mismatched expectations with lending and receiving. So that can break relationships, even though it started off being a generous thing. I'm sure we can come up with more. This is a big area, actually, because we're dealing with stuff all the time. For example, we're in a school hall that we hire. Yeah, a certain amount of damage, I guess, is included in the price, but we should be good tenants of this space. They should enjoy having us, and we should take care of it as part of being a church using this space, and so on. Okay, well, we're going to try and look at the rest of the passage, and I've bitten off more than I can chew, so I'm not going to cover every verse, and there may be verses where you have questions, and I'm just not going to be able to answer them this week. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use the cycle that I've sort of been using since the Ten Commandments of shows us God, shows us ourselves, it shows us Jesus, and then it shows us Spirit living. And in these verses, I think there are basically three areas that are being covered, so from 22:16 to 23:9, which are compassion for the socially weak, devotion to the true God, and justice being upheld. And so I'll try and pick a verse for each of those, showing God, showing ourselves, showing Jesus, and showing Spirit living. And we'll see how that goes. So firstly, how do these laws show us God? Well, if we look for compassion for the socially weak, we find in Exodus 22, verses 21 to 27, this concern for the weak. And God commands compassion for the widow and the fatherless. And he doesn't just say, because it's right, but he grounds it in his own character. When they cry out to me about injustice, I will hear, for I am compassionate. The sort of rules you make reflect your character, and God's rules are concerned to stop people exploiting others, and especially the weak, because he loves and he feels for the weak. He is a compassionate God. And that's not what we think powerful beings like, because I don't know if you noticed, but by and large, rich and powerful and famous human beings hang out with other rich and powerful and famous human beings. Because we're all actually a bit weak and a bit needy, we kind of get our strength by hanging out with other people who are ideally perhaps a little bit richer and more powerful than us. We like to be with the special people and feel that it rubs off on us. But God, who is all-powerful, all-wealthy, supremely beautiful and worshipped, doesn't favour the rich and the powerful. He doesn't say, I'm looking for the made-it human beings, they're my preference to hang out with. In his overflowing glory, God draws near to the lowly and the outcast, the weak and the broken. And he draws near with genuine compassion. He cares for them. He genuinely wants what is good for them. God is a compassionate God. Some of you need to know that truth this morning, because you feel like, I'm too sinful, or I'm too insignificant, I'm too much of an outsider, I'm too damaged for God to really pay attention to me. God is compassionate. He declares it now. I will hear their prayers because I am a compassionate God. God is also devoted to his own supreme greatness, to true worship. I guess it's hard to avoid noticing the harshness of some of these verses. For example, 22 verses 18 to 20 have the death penalty for sorceresses, for sex relations with animals, for sacrifices to any god other than the Lord. And you think, that's very harsh. But it reflects how devastating it is for human beings made by God to engage in the worship of false gods and to turn away from God's good ways. God is committed to helping his people worship the true God only, because what we worship controls us and shapes us. And the false gods shape us for destruction, while the true and living God gives life. And so God won't let you value anything more than him, in the same way that we wouldn't let a young child who has inherited a fortune trade away their fortune for some sweets. God knows what's truly rich for us, and he calls us to it, and he does everything he can to stop us going elsewhere. True and lasting happiness comes when we know that God is the greatest and best thing. God is devoted to his own supreme greatness, to true worship of him, and he upholds true justice. At chapter 23 and verse 7, have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. So God says to the judges of the system, the powerful system, make your human justice system fair, because I am going to judge you, and I will be fair. And if you have been convicting innocent people and putting them to death, I will not then acquit you of your guilt. We're all going to stand before God in his court one day. And as judge on that day, God will reveal absolute right and wrong. And every time we cross the lines doing wrong, he never says of the guilty, oh yes, don't worry, it doesn't really matter. It was only a small sin. He never pretends it didn't happen. He never says, oh, you were so rich and famous, I'll let you off. He's the just judge of the universe, and he will judge fairly. So that's just a taster, a sprinkling of these verses. God's character is seen, his compassion, his devotion to his own supreme greatness, and his justice in these laws. But if these laws are a window onto Jesus, they're also a mirror onto our own hearts. And so what we see is that if God has to give all these commands to his people, what that shows is that the human heart generally lacks compassion, devotion to God, and a love for true justice. So look at 22 verse 21. Do not mistreat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. Do not take advantage of the widow or the fatherless. And here is a rather bleak exposure of the human heart. There is something inside of many of us human beings which sees other human beings who are weak and poor and thinks, I can take advantage in this situation. I can get my way because they are too weak to stop me. Some of this is individual and it can be very ugly. The sexual exploitation of the weak who need food for their families. The unfairly low wages of someone who doesn't speak English well enough to understand the system. Some of this is more societal. Those who are weak and outcast don't get their voices heard, so that their needs aren't met while wealthier people get heard and get more. But we need to recognize this in many situations we are in. We will use our power for our own advantage rather than to serve those who have less power than us. Our selfish sin emerges very easily. We also lack devotion to God. So 22 verse 29 says, do not hold back offerings from your granaries or your vats. There's a human tendency that's exposed by this command to say, all the income, all the money's mine. And it's all for me. And God says, basically, I gave you all the money and you should honor me with a little bit of it coming back. We should offer some of what we've earned to God, knowing he's given us everything. And this command exposes our heart, which doesn't really honor God and thank God. These verses about justice expose our hearts too, because I don't know if you know, maybe I'm the only one in this room like this. I would like to think that I'm devoted to true justice, but usually I'm devoted to getting my way. So I want quick and harsh judgments on those who are against us, and very careful processes with compassion and mitigating circumstances for my side. And so you have all these commands against bribes in verse 8, denying justice to the poor, siding with the crowd, showing favoritism to the poor. Just worth noticing, both being unfair to the poor or favoring the poor is a problem. Lying in court. All of these expose the ways that human beings will tend to use justice as a weapon to get our own way or to enrich ourselves. So I say I want everyone to be dealt with rightly, but, you know, I really want the police to catch the idiot who was speeding through the village and give them a proper fine, and I can't believe they're wasting time on mere speeding when I'm the idiot speeding through the village. Yeah? It's that sort of tendency in all of us to go, I want justice harshly and quickly delivered when it's someone else. I want everything to sort of be waived when it's my turn. And this is just what goes on all the time. It doesn't matter which side of the debate you're on, really. You might be on the side that tends to naturally think, oh, it's the respectable person who must be in the right. Or you might be on the side who thinks, oh, it's the person who's the underdog who's right. But we'll often come in with a bias rather than a concern for true justice. And so God gives us these laws because he knows what the human heart is like. Particularly when we're in the wrong, we'll try and use justice for our own gain. So we've seen these laws give us a window to God. They hold up a mirror to our hearts, and then they point us to Jesus' work. They show us Jesus. And you might be thinking, well, how are you going to do that? How does that work? Well, what we see here is God's priorities, and then we see that that helps us to understand who Jesus is and what happens to Jesus. So, for example, we see compassion in these verses. And then we get to the Gospels, and we see that Jesus really shows this sort of compassion. Verses 4 and 5 of chapter 23, a slightly odd sort of little bit in the middle of a law court bit. If you come across your enemy's ox or donkey wandering off, be sure to return it. If you see the donkey of someone who hates you fallen down under its load, do not leave it there. Be sure you help them with it. And it seems to me that Jesus takes that compassion in that verse and says, you must do everything to help your enemy. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. He has compassion even on his enemies. He treats them as people in need rather than as enemies to be destroyed, even though they are against him. Of all Jesus' commands, this, I think, is the one I find hardest. Combined with turn the other cheek, love your enemies. But here is Jesus who says, even when people are doing wrong to me, I see them as people who are made in the image of God, who are lost and needy, and therefore I have compassion on them. Therefore I pray for them. Therefore I seek their good. He has compassion on every human being that he's made. And he's also wholly devoted to God the Father. He never gets self-obsessed or selfish or proud. All that language of giving the firstborn of your sons and being a holy people at the end of chapter 22, that is Jesus. He's the firstborn son who's wholly devoted to his heavenly Father. And he's the holy son who truly belongs to God. And he upholds justice in the most amazing way by bringing together true compassion and true devotion to God. Because at the cross, he takes upon himself the penalty for blaspheming God, for treating what is supremely good as worthless. He takes the penalty of chapter 22 and verse 20. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed. And God is just. He never simply acquits the guilty. We are all of us, though, guilty. We all have this inbuilt tendency to push God out of the way, to make ourselves most important and other things the greatest goal or our great fortress and strength, what we rely on. We're all guilty of failing to be devoted to God as the greatest thing, the greatest goal, the greatest strength. And so based on our own life, God would not be able to overlook us or our crime, acquit us of our crimes. But in his compassion, he takes the crime upon himself. He takes the penalty for our crime. Jesus, in his compassion for his people, willingly steps into our place. He doesn't pervert justice. He says, I will take your sin on myself. And the right anger of God at your sin, he takes on himself all our lack of compassion, all our injustice, all our constant turning from the true God, who is so vast and mighty and good and beautiful. Jesus steps in so that the guilty ones, us, may go free, not by unjustly overlooking sin, but by compassionately taking sin on himself to destroy it for us. And in this concern for justice, compassion, and devotion to God, in all these working together, what happens to Jesus is he achieves supreme divine justice by suffering human injustice. He was convicted by the Jewish Sanhedrin for declaring the truth that he was God and God's king. Look with me for a moment at Exodus 22 and verse 28. Do not blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people. But at the trial of Jesus, that is what they do. God comes, their king comes, and they say, we don't believe you. We will kill you. And at his trial, it was almost as if they read Exodus 23, 1-9 and said, how can we break every single one of these? So At his trial, there were false witnesses. Do not spread false reports. Do not help a guilty person by being a malicious witness. That was Jesus' trial. Think of Pilate. Do not follow the crowd, verse 2, in doing wrong. But Pilate fails to uphold justice when he condemns Jesus to death. Have nothing to do with a false charge, verse 7, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death. Here's Pilate. Jesus achieves the ultimate in divine justice, a rescuing, compassionate justice by enduring the worst of human injustice. And these laws in Exodus set the scene for understanding Jesus. If the law convicts us of our sinful hearts, it also points us to the one who will not fail as we did. He will use his righteousness, his devotion, his compassion to rescue us in this great and mysterious exchange. He takes our sin and judgment. He gives us his righteous status with God in an exchange that is both justice and compassion and leads us back to God. And so, finally, these verses show us spirit living. They show us what it means to live as a disciple of Jesus, helped by his spirit. Because the law shows us God's character, Jesus rescues us from falling short, but he also then helps us to live with God and like God. To follow Jesus and have the spirit at work in our hearts so that we are compassionate and devoted to God and pursue justice. So we can come back to these laws and read them, not as just an ancient law code for Israel, not even as a convicting document, here's the list of your crimes, but also as the gloriously good way that we can live as God's people. So we're to be compassionate. Twice in our passage, the Israelites' attitude to foreigners is shaped by their experience of being foreigners. In chapter 22 and verse 21, do not mistreat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. And so we're not just to love the people who are like us or who can pay us back, but also the outsider and the needy. Because God has shown love to us who are outsiders, outside of his people, and desperately needy. God is compassionate to outsiders, so we should be compassionate to outsiders, sharing God's heart of concern for every human being. We're now called to be God's holy people in chapter 2 and verse 31, drawn back to reality and blessing. You see, those who treat God as unimportant or not real or a tyrant are living in unreality. God is truly the greatest, most real thing there is, and he is the source of everything good. And so if you say, I'm going to cut myself off from that reality, I don't want God, he's not really great, he's not really there, I don't want him, it's cutting yourself off from the source of living water, it's cutting yourself off from the sun, and it's inherently running into foolish and deadly darkness. Jesus has rescued us from that foolishness of running away from God, and now we're set free to see reality and to bathe in it. God is supremely good and great, and to live in true blessing is to live connected to him and seeing him as great and living day by day, saying, God, you're the greatest thing. I want to live with you. I want to live for you. So we're to be compassionate. We're to be God's holy people. We're called to love justice. And love justice not as a weapon for our own gain. After all, we're no longer needy and desperate. God is for us and has promised us eternal riches. We'll inherit everything with Jesus. So I don't need the approval of the internet or more and more money or a sense of power and purpose. When I pursue justice, it's just because I want to see what is right done. I want to see relationships reconciled. Because God cares about it and one day will bring perfect justice. And here and now, I'm his child. And I want to care about the things he cares about. I'm not a partisan who cares for justice only when it's the other side doing wrong. I love justice because it's fair and right and good. I myself will confess when I'm in the wrong. Not force other people to prove that I'm wrong, but I'll confess it. And I'll try and make things right as best I can. It takes a miracle of the Spirit to love justice like this. If you've not trusted Jesus, I'm so glad you're here with us. It's really important to know that trusting him comes before trying to do the Spirit living. You can't solve the problems in the human heart that the law exposes here. You can't do that by yourself. You can't simply change your heart to be truly compassionate, truly loving justice, truly devoted to God. But Jesus can. He can take away your record of failure, your shame at the things you've done wrong, and he can pour his Spirit into you to help you change. So if you have not yet trusted in Jesus, come to him as Lord and Savior, the truly compassionate one, devoted to the Father, who endured injustice to bring true and lasting justice and rescue. Come to Jesus first. And for those here who have come to Jesus, those who say, yep, Jesus is my Lord and Savior, then welcome his work in you. Welcome his word. Let the Bible keep exposing your shortfall so that you can look again to Christ and be thankful and then be transformed in how you view the world and live following Jesus. Welcome God's word as your sure guide for life. Welcome God's Spirit as the living water your soul needs, the life-giving power to be more like God in this world. And it may be that the Spirit has taken a particular word or verse this morning, and you know you need, this is the area where I need to take a step in following Jesus. Maybe it's property, or maybe it's compassion, or maybe it's devotion, or maybe it's justice. And you know, this is an area I must take some steps in following Jesus. And so just, if that's been happening, just pause now and clarify in your mind, what is it that God has been saying to me? And perhaps just sort of make a mental note, I'm going to pray about that some more. Maybe I'm going to pray about it right now. Maybe I'm going to write it down. Maybe I'm going to ask a friend to pray for me in this area. But if God is pointing an area where you can become more like Jesus, where you can live by the Spirit more, don't just let it fade away. Follow in Christ's footsteps and let even these very old words from the law that came before Jesus shape you so that you live by the Spirit and follow Christ. May we grow in compassion for the weak and needy. May we grow in devotion to the true God. And may we grow in concern for true justice all around us. Amen.